This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents No Rest for the Dead by Jeff Abbott, Laurie Armstrong, Sandra Brown, Thomas Cook, Jeffrey Deaver, Diana Gabaldon, Tess Gerritsen, Andrew F. Gooley, Peter James, J.A. Jantz, Faye Kellerman, Raymond Corey, John Lasqua, Jeff Lindsay, Gail Linds, Philip Margolin, Alexander McCall Smith, Michael Palmer, T. Jefferson Parker, Matthew Pearl, Kathy Reichs, Marcus Sakey, Jonathan Santlofer, Lisa Scottolini, R. L. Stein, and Marcia Talley. Edited by Andrew F. Gooley and Lemia J. Gooley, with an introduction written by David Baldacci. Read by James Colby, Jonathan Davis, Richard Ferrone, Eliza Foss, Carol Monda, and Tom Steckschulte.
Introduction by David Baldacci. With the typical mystery story, readers are enthralled by the talents and imagination of only one writer. However, with this crime caper, the reader will enjoy the skillful spoils of 26 esteemed wordsmiths who craft plots, wield poisons, and toggle the life-death switch with the best of them. This is a rare thing indeed, because mystery writers are notoriously reclusive, paranoid, and unfriendly folks when it comes to their work. They like calling the final shots in their novels. Such absolute power is intoxicating, if only for its rarity, particularly if they've sold their work to Hollywood and find that their power has withered to less than zero. However, outside the realm of stories, and with drink in hand, they are interesting and convivial people who always have a crowd around them at parties, as all good storytellers do. That so many have agreed to craft chapters in the tale you're about to plunge into is as much a testament to the persuasive powers of the editors at the Strand magazine as it is to the graciousness of the creators assembled here. Mysteries are the guilty cheats of the book world. Some highbrow critics and reviewers look down on them in public and then eagerly read them on the subway hidden behind an absolutely pristine copy of Ulysses, bubbling with the pleasure of the child who has just discovered Sherlock Holmes. It is also perhaps the sole arena on processed paper where the reader can match wits with the creator. If you're really good, you can sometimes arrive at the answer before the creator wants you to. You may also cry, as you do with love story weepies, or laugh, as you may at the pratfalls of comic characters, or be horrified as only horror stories can induce. Yet with the unique class of the whodunit, you may enjoy all of those emotional swings and still be primed and poised to reveal the answer prematurely. And if you do succeed in besting the creator, you, of course, have de facto license to race to Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com or else your personal blog and crow about your victory to the digital heavens. However, here, I believe you will have met your match. The lineup of writers who have contributed to this mystery is akin to the murderer's row of the 1927 New York Yankees. There is not a weak spot in the bunch. You will be enthralled as much by the charming quirks provided by individual voices as the story passes from one creator's mind to the next, as you will by the quality of the tale. While they each deliver their own signature brand of storytelling to the novel, it is startling how these writers, several of whom are friends of mine, have woven a yarn that seems to be the product of one mind, one imagination, albeit schizophrenic, and one on steroids of such strength that even Major League Baseball would ban them, and that is indeed saying something. The story kicks off with a bang. A murderess was executed 10 years ago. Rosemary Thomas brutally killed her husband, Christopher Thomas. stuffing his body inside an Iron Maiden and shipping it to the German Historical Museum of Berlin. Everyone knows she did it, though a few doubts linger, which led to the detective in charge losing his bearings and his wife. Then a stunner comes along. A memorial service is planned for Rosemary on the 10th anniversary of her execution. All the usual suspects and several folks with passable motives to have done the deed are invited. The scene is set. I won't give away any more than that because it would be unfair to the creators who have worked hard to put this all together. Yet I will add that if you were expecting an Agatha Christie ending where Poirot or Marple stands up, calmly lays out the case, and reveals the true murderer, you're in for a shock. The creators have, collectively, another denouement in mind. And in my humble opinion, it's a twist that is so original, you won't have to concern yourself with bragging on your blog about how you figured it all out long before the conclusion. Well, I guess you still can, but you'd be lying. If this were a peer review process, I'd give everyone involved a glowing report. A vigilant reader can certainly tell when a writer is operating at a high level. But it really takes another writer to delve into the nuances of a story, break it down like game film, and truly see the effort that has gone into the product. We can well appreciate what it takes because we aspire to do it with every book. Being merely human, sometimes we triumph and sometimes we don't. Yet there's nothing like drilling a line just right, honing a plot twist to perfection, or tooling a character arc until it gleams with the shine of genius. All of which originates with the sweat on the writer's brow. It's hard, what these writers have done. Give them their due. When you've finished with the story, tell your friends to read it. Let them in on the fun. Tell them it's a brain twister for sure, and, okay, you can tell them you figured it out in the last three pages and therefore found it a bit predictable, but they won't. Which will make you look like a person who is several pay grades above the FBI's best. And everyone will have a good time enjoying the simple and complex experience of tearing through a great mystery. Read on.
Diary of John Nunn by Andrew F. Gooley. August 2010. There is always that case, the one that keeps me awake at night, the one that got away. It'll always be there, gnawing at the edges of my mind. It doesn't matter that 10 years have passed. It doesn't matter that the case is officially closed. An innocent woman was executed. I was the one who helped make it happen. And on the sad night when the needle was inserted into her arm, injecting her with death, part of my life ended too. Back then I thought I was working a straightforward case, but every action I was taking was a step closer to ending it for Rosemary, destroying her life and mine. I thought I had the facts, the physical evidence, the blood-stained blouse, the missing button, her fingerprints, her contradictory answers during the investigation, the public argument she had had with her husband after he demanded a divorce, her trip to Mexico the week he went missing when she'd told her friends that she doubted Christopher would ever come back. Of course she was right. He never did come back. Not alive. Christopher Thomas's badly decayed body was found inside an Iron Maiden in the German Historical Museum of Berlin several weeks later. It seemed like a simple case, crazy but simple. In a fit of rage, Rosemary Thomas killed her husband, then dragged his body inside the Maiden, because she knew that it was going to be shipped back to Germany. It didn't take long for the jury to convict her. An open and shut case. And yet, it never felt right, never made sense. Sure, there was motive and opportunity. There was the physical evidence. But if you met her, if you knew her the way I got to know her. But it wasn't until later, after I'd taken a step back from the case, that I realized it had angles I hadn't seen, layers I hadn't uncovered. Back when it mattered, back when I could have saved her, back when I was too busy making sure not to let any personal feelings for the suspect interfere with my duty. Back when I was standing too close to see anything clearly. Maybe some of you have seen the movie Vertigo. Well, picture me as the guy who was manipulated like a puppet, and whose life unravels as a result. Luckily, I had a friend. When I was lost and close to suicide after Sarah left, Tony Olson picked me up and never let me feel that I was a burden, or that he was doing me any favors. When I was drinking myself into oblivion, it was Tony who brought me to his home, made sure I stayed away from drink, gave me a job handling security for his firm. The crazy thing is, he'd also been a friend of Rosemary's. You'd think after what I had done, he'd want me dead. I gave up drinking, but the ghosts remained. And for years, both drunk and sober, I've fantasized about getting all the suspects together, all those I'd mistakenly ruled out, getting at the facts and exacting justice for Rosemary, for her kids, for my own life. It took me a long time, but I managed to convince Tony to help me. I needed closure, and it could only come from a second bite of that poisoned apple. It's why now, all these years later, I need to get the principals together in one place. I need to confront the people who might have done it. But Tony was right. We couldn't just ask them to come together, to give me another crack at solving the case. We talked a lot about it, how we could get them all together. But the answer was there all the time. The memorial that Rosemary had requested in her last will and testament, to commemorate the 10th anniversary of her death. The innocent would pay their respects. The guilty would attend to avoid rousing suspicion. And why worry? Rosemary had been found guilty and executed. No DA in his right mind was going to reopen the case. They would all come, I was sure of it. Some of them wearing innocence like a mask. I've been an agnostic all my life. I've never believed in anything. I can't imagine the phoenix rising from the ashes. From what I've seen, ashes always remain ashes, and sooner or later everything rots and decays. But with this idea of bringing them together, of finally uncovering the guilty party, I was going to resurrect myself. You're probably thinking I'm just a policeman obsessed with a case he couldn't crack. But you're wrong. It's more than that. I have to know the truth. The truth about Rosemary and the truth about who really killed Christopher Thomas. You see, I have to find out who destroyed my life. Who slept well the night Rosemary Thomas knew she'd never again see the bright morning through her cold prison bars.
Prologue by Jonathan Santlofer. August 23rd, 2000. Valley State Prison for Women, Chowchilla, California. I am already a ghost. Rosemary Thomas stared at her long fingers painted with stripes, the cell's bars casting shadows. She raised her hand and studied it as if it were a newly discovered specimen, noting the pale blue veins under translucent flesh. Yes, she thought, I am disappearing. She traced fingertips across her cheeks like a blind woman touching a stranger's face, could barely feel them, barely take in the reality of her situation. I have less than an hour to live. How did this happen? She whispered to no one, yet it was real and she knew it, knew that her husband, Christopher, had been murdered, knew that he had absurdly been sealed into an 18th-century torture device on loan to her department of the museum, knew that all of the evidence somehow pointed to her. Wife's fingerprints on Iron Maiden. Just one of many headlines in the many newspapers that detailed the crime, her crime, or so the district attorney had proved. Rosemary pictured him, an aging peacock in a three-piece suit. How he'd lobbied loudly and publicly for equality, no deals for the rich, his motto throughout the trial, with his re-election only weeks away and something he was not going to trade for the life of one rich woman. He'd gone for blood on day one, asking a surprised judge and jury for the death penalty and nothing less. Her case had become a cause célèbre, pro-life versus pro-death forces having a field day. Funny, thought Rosemary, that it had taken a murder to finally get her some attention. Had it not been an election year with the DA, the judge, and the governor up for re-election, her lawyer insisted she would have gotten a reduced sentence. But it was an election year, and she was going to die. When had it happened? When had she finally given up hope? When her brother's words condemned her? Or when the cop, John Nunn, whom she'd trusted, had given his damning testimony? She thought of the burly cop on the stand, hair a mess, 3 days' growth of beard, the dark circles under his eyes. And how, when he'd finished testifying, he'd glanced over at her with eyes so sad that she'd nodded in spite of her anger, as if to say she understood he was doing his job, even as she realized that the prosecution now had all they needed, and the absolute certainty of her fate washed over her. Rosemary sighed, took in the bare walls of the special security cell where she'd been moved after she'd lost her last appeal. She had lived with 2 weeks of hourly checks, the death watch, as it was known, a guard taking notes as if there were something to report. The inmate moved from bed to chair. The inmate did not eat her dinner. The inmate wrote in her diary, "The inmate is crying." Yes, she had cried. But not anymore. She was past tears. That's what she had told the psychiatrist and the chaplain and the caseworker, all of them well-meaning but useless. What could they do for her? She was sane. She'd been born a Christian, but was now an agnostic. She was charitable. She'd actually said that to the caseworker, and the absurdity of the statement had made them both laugh. Was it the last time she would ever laugh? Rosemary paced across the tiny cell, back and forth, hand tapping her side, adrenaline coursing through her veins. She hadn't slept but wasn't tired, the evidence against her replaying on automatic. The blouse, the button, her strands of hair, the fight, the fingerprints. But none of it mattered now. She was going to die. Today, her last 24 hours, she'd felt almost resigned to her fate. That was how she'd described her state of mind to her friend and only visitor, Belle McGuire. Loyal, dependable Belle. She had given Belle something to safeguard until the children were older, but would it even matter in 10 years' time? It would to Ben and Layla. It always would to them. Rosemary squeezed her eyes shut at the thought of her children. She'd refused the nanny who offered to bring them to say goodbye. How do you say goodbye forever to your children? How do you explain this to them? She sagged onto her cot, played with a loose thread at the cuff of her orange jumpsuit, wrapped it so tightly around her finger the tip turned white until the picture of another finger, Christopher's finger, flashed in her mind along with other crime scene photos of her dead husband's decomposed body. Rosemary pushed herself up from the cot, 6 steps to the bars, pressed her cheek against cold steel, squinted to read the clock at the far end of the hall. But why? To tell her that the minutes of what was left of her life were ticking away? She turned away and stared at the tray on the edge of her bed, stains blooming through the napkin. Her last meal, a cheeseburger and fries, ordered when the sad, smiling guard said she could have anything she wanted. Anything? A new trial? Freedom? Her life? She'd returned the woman's sad smile. "I don't care," she'd said. And when the cheeseburger had arrived oozing blood, with fat French fries lapping up the liquid like leeches, she'd covered it with a napkin, the thought of eating impossible. She hadn't been able to eat in weeks, living on tea and crackers and, last night, a few cherries Belle had brought from her garden, which had stained her fingers like blood. A shadow fell across the bars, and Rosemary looked up. The warden, three guards, and the prison chaplain. "It's time," said the guard, the one with the sad, kind face, a heavy-set woman whom Rosemary had come to know during the time she'd spent behind bars. Images fluttered through her mind like a series of snapshots, standing beside her father, his stern face turned away from hers as it always was, an awkward debutante at her coming-out party, tall and gangly, and in white lace on her wedding day, Christopher Thomas beside her. Christopher, her beautiful shining knight. Christopher, who had betrayed her. "Are you ready?" the guard asked, unable to meet Rosemary's eyes. An absurd question, thought Rosemary. What if I say, "No, I'm not ready"? What then? She imagined herself tearing down the hall, the guards running after her, inmates cheering and jeering. But she said, "Yes, I'm ready." There were no handcuffs, no chains, just guards on either side of her, the prison chaplain carrying an open Bible, the warden leading the way. How odd, thought Rosemary, that I feel nothing. The sad, kind guard held her arm, and the hallway stretched out in front of her. A fluorescent light flickered. The walk seemed to take forever. They led her through an oval-shaped door into an octagonal room, and Rosemary saw the gurney that filled half the space and a table with tourniquets and needles laid out and windows all around, and she realized it was a show and that she was the main attraction. She gasped. Breath caught in her throat. She felt her legs go weak, sagged, and might have fallen if the guard didn't have a firm grip on her arm. "Are you okay?" the woman asked. Rosemary said, "I'm fine," thinking, "I will be dead soon." They were led, like mourners, through a side door that opened into a circular passageway that surrounded the execution chamber. John Nunn watched as the witnesses assumed positions, like sentries at each of the five windows, curtains drawn. They stared at the glass, at faint distorted reflections of themselves. He looked from one to another, the district attorney, for once quiet, the judge, a woman who'd played tough along with the DA, nervously wringing her hands. Rosemary's brother, Peter, who had practically banged into him only moments earlier, booze on his breath. The reporter, Hank Zacharias. There were other reporters, too, guards and state officials, everyone somber and stony except for Belle McGuire, Rosemary's friend, face flushed and crying, the only one seemingly overcome by emotion. Nunn thought of Rosemary the first time he'd met her, how tough she'd pretended to be, and hoped she could muster some of that toughness today, though his own reserve was empty. Earlier this evening, he and Sarah had argued, not for the first time, about the trial, the crime, Sarah saying that the case had become his obsession and he could no longer answer her accusations or deny them, and he stormed out, as he had on so many other nights, leaving her behind, fuming. He'd hung out in a bar till it closed, then found another that stayed open all night. Peter Hewson was not the only one with booze on his breath tonight. The tie-down team had strapped her to the gurney, five big men to tie down one small woman, a man at her head, one on each arm, one for each leg. Now there were straps across her chest, wrists, abdomen. The sound of Velcro restraints opening and closing still playing in Rosemary's ears. "Rest your head on the pillow," one said. "Rest my head? Are they kidding?" But she did. Even said, "Thank you." Always the well-brought-up girl. She thought of her mother, and for once was glad her parents were dead. She stared at the ceiling, the walls. Counted gray tiles versus white ones, anything to keep her mind occupied. Spotted the camera and thought, They are recording my death. And prayed she would be dignified, that she wouldn't scream and that her body wouldn't betray her with spasms. She couldn't bear the thought of that. Okay, said the man at her head, and the one at her leg touched her ankle so gently, so tenderly, she fought to control her tears. The tie-down crew was replaced by a medical team, technicians wrapping tubes around her arms, flicking at her flesh to find veins. She caught sight of the catheters and shivered. Can you make a fist? One asked, and she did, pretending they were just taking blood, and thought of the blood test she'd taken before she was married and how excited she'd been to become Mrs. Christopher Thomas. How much she'd hoped for and how little had come true. She thought of the nights she lay awake, humiliated, waiting for him, knowing he was in another woman's bed, wishing him dead, wanting to kill him. One of the technicians missed the vein, and Rosemary flinched, tears automatically springing to her eyes. No, don't cry. She squeezed her eyes shut. Again and again, the technicians tried and failed until one of them finally said, There, that's one, while the other continued to stab her arm over and over. The veins have gone totally flat, he said. Not her veins, the veins. She wanted to scream, I'm still alive! Let me help, said the other one. The two of them poking at her arm, dark shadows looming over her, and an image came to her. In the vet's office years ago, having her cocker spaniel put to sleep, the old dog riddled with cancer. How merciful it had seemed. The dog nestled peacefully in her arms while the vet got the IV going. You're just going to sleep, she had said, tears in her eyes, and had believed that until the creature let out a deep guttural yelp. Something she'd never heard before, and Rosemary had to steady his soft old body, pet him and whisper assurances, there, there, until the drug got into his bloodstream and he went limp. She came back to the moment, looked at the group of people in the chamber and wondered, where are my assurances? Okay, said the technician, taping the second IV to her arm. We finally got it. Please, God, let it be over quickly, thought Rosemary. The technicians left, and the warden and the chaplain came in. The warden raised his hand, and the curtains opened, and she saw them. Her heart pounding, Rosemary thought, my audience. Some are witnesses to my death, some are participants. Her brother, Peter Hewson, drunk already, she could tell, from the bleary eyes. She'd refused to see Peter this morning. He'd simply been trying to cleanse his conscience, she knew. There were other faces, too, people she didn't know, and there was Belle, crying, watching Rosemary through the glass. And John Nunn, who had tried to visit, but she'd refused him as she had every other time he had requested. They locked eyes, and he smoothed his shirt, then brushed absently at his stubble, as if suddenly upset at his rumpled appearance. Rosemary scanned the crowd, and her eyes stopped on Hank Zacharias, the journalist, her friend. He'd argued in article after article that they were executing an innocent woman, a woman who had been railroaded by an avid prosecutor and judge. She could still remember his attempts to question the evidence. Hank Zacharias tried to convince himself that he'd come strictly as a witness and reporter, not as a friend, that he'd write one last piece detailing the horrors of capital punishment, and that the writing would distance him from the event, but his heart was beating fast and his mouth had gone dry. He stared through the glass at Rosemary and took several deep breaths. He couldn't help but notice how thin Rosemary had grown. The once delicate bone structure of her face now skull-like, her bony arms bruised where the technicians had made their clumsy attempts to insert the 14-gauge catheters, the largest commercially available needles, that would deliver the mix of anesthetic and poison to stop Rosemary's heart. He thought about how hard he'd tried to prevent this from happening. His mind kept going back to the articles he'd written about the case. Christopher Thomas's body was found in an advanced state of decomposition due to its incarceration in a contraption known as an Iron Maiden, which acted as a kind of pressure cooker. The device also crushed the deceased's teeth, though an identifiable fragment was discovered in the Iron Maiden itself. This reporter has argued that it would have been impossible for the accused, a 130-pound woman, to have lifted a man of more than 6 feet and 180 pounds into the Iron Maiden by herself. The state has put forth the idea that she had help from a known drug runner who had been seen at the McFall Art Museum and who has subsequently and conveniently disappeared from sight. If Rosemary Thomas is executed on evidence that could have been planted, it will be the result of a witch hunt, of politicos saving their jobs, of trying to prove the wealthy can be treated as badly as the poor. But Zacharias's writings were tainted by his having known Rosemary since college, by their having been friends, and their relationship was used to discredit him. He is partial. He is a friend. He is distorting the evidence. And it didn't help that he'd written a series of anti-capital punishment articles for Rolling Stone just a few months earlier, which made it look as if he were simply taking up his cause once again. Zacharias stared past Rosemary and, through the glass opposite, saw Peter Hewson weaving slightly as if he might fall. He's drunk, thought Zacharias. Rosemary's goddamn brother is drunk. Peter Hewson was having trouble keeping down his breakfast of Eggs Benedict, chased by two tumblers of bourbon. His stomach roiled and his head ached. He swallowed hard and worried he might be sick. He saw himself in the witness box stating how his sister had, more than once, said she'd wanted her husband dead. Of course, he'd added that he was certain it was just a figure of speech. Though one could hardly blame my sister if she did kill that philandering scoundrel. I mean, who wouldn't? Peter Hewson swallowed again. What he wouldn't do for another glass of bourbon. He licked his lips and thought of Rosemary's young children, Layla and Ben, at home with their nanny, and what he would say to them later. Oh, your poor dear mother. He glanced at his older sister and thought how she'd always taken care of him. Rosemary the Responsible, that's what he'd called her. And he felt a tremor through his body. Even now she looked responsible, in control. Always the opposite of me, he thought, and swallowed again and caught her eyes. The warden took up his position at Rosemary's head. The chaplain, by her side, asked, "Do you have anything to say?" She looked again at the people on the other side of the windows and saw the district attorney and the judge, those who stopped at nothing to see that justice was done. Justice? Oh, do I have some things to say? And she must have nodded because a boom mic descended from the ceiling. But instead, Rosemary shut her eyes and pictured her childhood bedroom, she and her mother kneeling beside her bed. Now I lay me down to sleep. She heard her words amplified through the mic and felt a hand on her arm, imagined it was her mother, though she knew it was the chaplain. If I should die before I... But the words suddenly made no sense. There was no if. Rosemary tried to make her mind a blank, but images of her children bloomed like developing photographs, beautiful, innocent faces. And she could not stop herself from thinking that she would never see them again, never see them grow older, would miss their teenage years and college and marriages and grandchildren. And though she tried not to, a strangled sob burst out of her. Melissa Franklin Forrest heard the cry and flinched. She had been staring at a spot above Rosemary's head, anything to avoid the woman's eyes. But now, hearing that sound and seeing the tears on Rosemary's face, she felt her own tears gathering. She'd spent more than half her life as a judge and was considered a fair one. She had fought for re-election more than once, but right now it felt as if all of the good work she'd done was behind her, that this was the one act she would be remembered for, the one that would haunt her for the remainder of her life. She had not wanted to be here, had not wanted to be a witness, but the state had insisted. She twisted a plain gold band around her finger, tried to breathe normally, though her heart raced and her head felt light. Had she not been easy on that rapist? Had she not set him free to rape again? Had it not been the case that preceded this one? But she had let a rapist go free, and it had been the case just before Rosemary's. Judge Forrest forced herself to look at Rosemary, at the straps that held her like a trapped animal, at the needles in her arms that would deliver the poison, and she thought, "Now I am guilty of murder, too." Rosemary felt the cool saline solution rushing into her veins. Then the warden removed his glasses, tilted his head toward a mirror, and Rosemary knew it was a signal, the signal, for the execution to begin. Behind the mirrored glass, the executioner started the process. First, the sodium thiopental, a fast-acting barbiturate that was the anesthetic. Then 50 milligrams of Pavilion, a muscle relaxer that would paralyze the diaphragm and arrest the breathing. Last, the potassium chloride, which would stop the heart. The chaplain asked again if she had anything to say, and Rosemary shook her head no as words tumbled from her mouth. "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no..." Then she swallowed and tasted something bitter on the back of her tongue, and the words caught in her throat, and the slight burning she'd felt in her arms became fire, and her body was shaking, writhing, and she couldn't stop gasping and gagging. "My God, my God!" Belle McGuire covered her face with her hands. "What's happening?" The curtains were quickly drawn, but Belle, the others, could hear moans and cries even through the glass. "It's worse than being stoned to death," Zacharias said, pale, glaring at Nunn. John Nunn squeezed his eyes shut. He had to control himself from pounding on the glass and smashing it. The medical team and the tie-down crew burst into the death chamber. "Shit!" A large black man tried to restrain Rosemary's convulsing body. One of the technicians yelled, "It's her arm! Look at the swelling! Jesus!" "The straps are too tight," the warden said. "Only a fraction of the chemical is getting through. You're killing her! Slowly! Get it off! Now!" One of the tie-down team tugged the strap off Rosemary's arm so fast it snagged the IV, and the needle whipped through the air like a snake spitting and spraying poison everywhere. "What is wrong with you people?" the warden bellowed, his face red. "There are state officials out there and reporters watching this. Jesus Christ!" He backed away to avoid a face full of paralyzing Pavilion. Rosemary's heart was beating normally again, and she watched all the drama around her as if it were some black comedy. Her joints ached and her muscles burned, but her mind was surprisingly clear. "You okay?" the technician asked, and she nodded. The chaplain was back, his hand on Rosemary's forehead. "It's okay, dear, it's okay." Then he started to pray as the technician got the catheters in place and Rosemary lay back against the pillow. Belle McGuire turned to Nunn. She was still crying. "Make them stop. Please make them stop."
"Not the first time I've seen something go wrong," one of the reporters said, shaking his head. "It'll get back on track in a few minutes."
Belle's face twisted with pain. But John Nunn couldn't wait a few minutes. He pounded his fist on the glass.
"Stop this! Stop it now!"
A guard was beside him in seconds. "Sir, you will have to leave if you don't..."
Nunn took one last half-swing at the glass, then let his hand drop and stared at the floor, taking fast, hard breaths. The curtains opened, and once again Rosemary looked at the witnesses. She tried to smile at Belle, then, scanning the windows, she found John Nunn, who leaned forward and pressed his hands against the glass, something he was not supposed to do, but this time no one stopped him. It was not at all as she'd imagined, some drug-induced stupor followed by sleep. Instead, Rosemary Thomas had become hyper-aware of her body, air going in and out of her lungs, bubbles of oxygen traveling along veins and arteries, heart pumping loud and clear, images sparking in her brain. Her father laid up in bed, her mother smoking a cigarette at his funeral, her children Ben and Layla calling to her. The Iron Maiden, a blood-soaked blouse, Christopher's face, his finger. Words, colors, everything whirling and mixing. She saw the district attorney looking solemn and the pain on the judge's face, and the guards and the doctor and the reporters staring but not really looking. Now she knew what was happening. Her breathing had become labored, and a sudden coldness surrounded her heart. Just before her eyes closed, she saw Belle McGuire crying and John Nunn's face, his fingertips pressed against the glass like white fluttering moths. It was as if his hand were on her arm. She wanted to call out, but it was impossible. She couldn't speak. A noise, like air going out of a balloon, filled Rosemary's ears, and she knew it was her last breath. And then her heart turned to ice and cracked and broke apart, and the world went bright white, and she was flying.
1998 Chapter 1 by Jeff Lindsay. The McFall Art Museum was closed for the night. Down in the main galleries, the security lights were on, throwing bright, ugly puddles of light on the doors and hallways. It was very different from the careful track lighting of the day, lovingly trained on the paintings and sculptures that lined the rooms to show them at their best, without glare or shadow. The illumination from these nighttime lights was harsh, hard-edged. The garish pools of light they threw made the museum seem darker somehow, more strange and threatening than a building filled with great art should have been. It wasn't a big museum, but it had made a name for itself in San Francisco. The Gem of the Bay Area, people called it, an undiscovered treasure trove of art from nearly every era. Near the marble staircase that led to the second floor, the sharply outlined shadow of a statue fell across the floor, the figure of a nude athlete holding half a javelin. The athlete had been dead for almost 2,500 years, and his javelin had been broken for 1,700. But still he stood poised for his throw. With the glare of the security light on his marble skin, that throw seemed imminent, adding to the strange sense of foreboding. From the far end of the back gallery, an eerie sound fluttered across the spotless tile floors. It echoed off the hard surfaces of the floor and walls until it was almost impossible to recognize it for what it was, the sound of a cheap radio playing a ball game. Moments later, the sound was joined by the scuffle of the night guard's feet as he walked back to the security station at the front door, where he put the radio down beside a bank of video monitors. The guard settled into his chair, just in time for the louder gabble of a tire commercial. The sound echoed up the first landing of the marble staircase, but somehow failed to turn the corner and make it to the second floor. At the top of the stairs, greater darkness waited to join the sudden silence. The pools of shadow were swept aside by one security light halfway down a hallway lined with office doors. The entire length of the hallway stood prey to the shadows, half dim and half lit by the small and ugly light from that one bare lamp. All the way down at the far end of the hall, One additional pool of light spilled out into the hallway from the half-open door of the corner office. It was a much warmer light, though not terribly bright. Then, quite suddenly, the light went out. For several moments, nothing else happened. No sound, no sign of any living thing moving anywhere near the corner office. But the careful observer might have noticed a strange, dark blue-purple glow coming from inside the room. Without really lighting anything properly, the glow somehow caused the lettering on the office door to jump out in almost three-dimensional clarity. Christopher Thomas, Curator. From the doorway, there was almost nothing to see in the darkness of the curator's office. The walls reflected a faint texture that had to be books, hundreds of them, lining the room from the floor all the way up beyond the reach of a normal human being. They seemed to loom above the room, holding in and magnifying the tense emptiness that gripped this museum tonight. And faintly visible in the dim blue-purple glow was one end of a large leather couch. At the other end of the room was a large draftsman's table with a lamp suspended above it on a gooseneck, and from this lamp came the glow. It shone down on a canvas stretched out on the table, and it reflected strangely off the thick square glasses worn by the man who leaned over the canvas. When the young woman beside him opened her mouth to take a ragged breath, it lit up her teeth with a brilliant and otherworldly sheen.
"It's quite clear under the ultraviolet light," the man said. Something about the way he said his words made them sound stilted, as if he were reading from a script. But the young woman didn't notice. She was staring at his hands as they hovered just above the canvas. Like the rest of the man, his hands were long and angular and strong. "Here," he said, "and again here."
He moved his hand in a choppy half-circle over the lower corner of the canvas. The young woman ran her tongue out and across her full lower lip. She looked closely at him, the light casting strange shadows into the angles of a face not classically handsome, the slightly hooked nose, the too thin lips. Yet, something about him was beautiful. Beautiful and dangerous.
"Are you listening?" he barked at her, her normally copper-colored skin edging toward purple in the light.
"Yes. Yes, of course."
"Look," he commanded. He made a padding motion over the canvas. "It's very good. The artist used old linen and real Prussian blue pigment, very expensive but fugitive, so it's turned to black, a nice touch."
The hand turned over, and the young woman watched with fascination.
"So expressive," she thought, staring at the fingertips as they fluttered.
"But," he said, quite suddenly one of the hands moved away and switched on the conventional light.
"Your soutine is a fake. You've spent a great deal of the museum's money on a fake."
As that statement hit home, she snapped her eyes away from those hands and onto the man's face.
"Fake," she said, shaking her head dazedly. "But that's... I have the provenance, and it was a good one, proving where the painting has been every moment since it left Soutine's studio in France in 1939.
The man straightened up. He was quite tall, and he inched closer to her. His movements, like his words, gave the impression of a bad actor, not quite sure how to act the part of human being.
"I read your provenance," he said. "It doesn't add up."
"But I talked to the family."
"You talked to con men."
"What?"
she gasped.
"The whole provenance is fake, like the painting."
"Oh, my God."
For a long moment, she thought about a promising career now smoldering in ruins. The years of graduate school, the overwhelming student loans she could barely pay, even with this prestigious job. And now, it was all over. She'd be fired, disgraced, permanently unemployed. All she had worked for her entire adult life, slipping away into shambles. The embarrassment she would share with her family, who had been so proud of her. the museum's first African-American curator, a symbol of sorts to her community, something she'd never wanted but had become.
"I'm afraid there's no doubt at all," the man said, putting those long hands of his together in front of him.
"Oh, dear God."
"A bit of a career killer, isn't it, Justine?"
He used her name as if it were in quotation marks.
There must be something,"
he smiled. His teeth were large, but white and strong-looking.
"Something we can do," he said mockingly, "to make it all go away, like it never happened?"
The young woman just shook her head.
"Or did you mean something I can do, to save your career? Hide your mistake, keep your life from sliding down the drain?"
"Is there?"
she blurted out. He stared at her for what seemed like a long time. Then he straightened and took another half-step toward her.
"There might be something, but..."
he shook his head.
"But what?"
Justine asked, barely breathing.
"It's a huge risk for me, personally and professionally. I would have to know that I can trust you completely."
"You can trust me? You're holding my career in your hands."
"Of course. But that's not enough."
He fluttered one of those big hands as if to say, "What's in it for me?" And she couldn't look away from it for several seconds. When she finally did, and their eyes met, there was really only one thing to say.
"I'll lock the door,"
she said. Later, after Justine was gone, Christopher Thomas sat up on the large leather couch and straightened his clothing. He felt rather pleased with himself, refreshed and ready to get on with the night's real work. He stood up and stretched, then moved over to his desk. Justine had provided a pleasant interlude, but a great deal was still left to do tonight. The desk telephone stood beside a 5x7 picture frame that held a shot of his wife, Rosemary, and their two children, a pleasant-looking family group, and Thomas felt mild affection for the three of them, nothing that would prevent him from gratifying his frequent urges for other women, of course. He seldom seemed to have any time to spend on his little family, what with his work as curator and his other less public projects, still. It was nice to have a family in the background. It made him feel so much more authentic and irreproachable, especially with Rosemary's pedigree. A child of wealth and privilege, marrying her had been one of the smartest moves he'd ever made. He gave the picture a brief, synthetic smile, pure reflex, and picked up the telephone, dialed a number from memory, and after hearing a curt "yes" on the other end, spoke.
"I have three paintings you will be interested in."
Again the corners of Thomas's mouth twitched upward in a mechanical smile, including a rather rare soutine. A moment of silence on the other end was followed by a harsh breath, an exhalation of cigarette smoke. Then the voice said, "Describe it to me." Thomas did. The wild, almost otherworldly exuberance of the brushwork, the sense of immediacy that jumped off the canvas and into the viewer's heart, assuming the viewer had a heart, which Thomas did not. But it didn't prevent him from gauging the effect this painting would have on others. Another long pause on the other end of the line was punctuated by two harsh breaths. Finally, the man said in a soft and raspy voice, "All right." Thomas smiled again. This time it looked a bit more like a real smile because he was about to get a great deal of money, and Christopher Thomas needed money. In spite of his rich wife and high-profile job, Christopher Thomas needed money badly and quickly.
"I'm sending three canvases to your restoration company tomorrow afternoon at 3:30, he said. "They will travel in a white panel truck with the museum's name and logo on the side. All right?" After one more long, harsh exhalation, the voice said softly, "Good." Then the line went dead.
Christopher Thomas hung up the phone, feeling pleased with himself. Tomorrow afternoon, the three paintings would disappear from the truck, taking them to be cleaned. Naturally, the museum would be upset, but they would also get a large check from the insurance company. And a collector somewhere would get three nice works of art, and Thomas would get a hefty chunk of cash. As an added bonus, the young woman who had recently left his couch would certainly be grateful that he had allowed her to keep her job. A return bout on the reliable leather couch was clearly in his future. So, a self-satisfied Christopher Thomas locked his office and went down the hall to the marble staircase. Things were looking up, and just in time. He mentally counted the money he would get as he headed down the stairs. He hit the landing and circled around, continuing down to the main floor of the museum. The sound of the guard's radio reached him, a roaring crowd that echoed into a confused blur and muffled the noise of his steps on the marble stairs. For just a moment, he allowed himself to pretend that the crowd was cheering for him. He had done it. Payday. Hooray for me, he thought. Thomas walked past the marble javelin thrower to the security station by the front door. Good night, Artie, he said to the guard. The man looked up, his face lit with an eerie glow from the half-dozen video screens that surrounded him. Hey, Mr. Thomas, you gonna call it a night?
Yes. We all have to go home sometime.
Thomas had arranged for Artie Ruby to get this job in security at the museum, despite Artie's checkered past. The way Thomas saw it, didn't hurt having a crooked ex-cop working for you in security. It even came in handy sometimes. Artie smiled.
Ain't it the truth? All right, you have a good night, Mr. Thomas.
Thomas nodded and moved to the front door, waiting for just a second before the guard pushed the security buzzer. Then he was out through the glass double doors and into the night. Thomas walked through the bright orange glare of the security lights on the front of the building and circled around back to the staff parking area. The long walk was annoying, particularly at the end of a hard day, but the insurance company insisted that the back door remain locked. Not that it would do them any good this time, he thought, wondering again just how much the soutine might bring. The parking lot was a great deal darker than the front of the building. It was normally lit by two large lights, one at each end, but Thomas saw that one of them, the one nearest his car, was out. He frowned and shook his head. Maintenance was supposed to check the lights regularly, again as dictated by the insurance company, and someone had neglected the job. He made a mental note to scold the maintenance people in the morning. He certainly didn't need trouble with the insurance company. Not right now, when they were about to write the museum a hefty check. Still shaking his head at this carelessness, he fished out the car keys from his pocket and stepped over to his car, a 2-year-old BMW. As he unlocked the car and reached down to open the door, he felt, more than saw, a shape slip out of the shadows by the building's dumpster and come up behind him. Before he could turn around or even straighten up, something cold and hard pressed into the back of his neck, and a voice said, "Get in the car." Thomas froze. For a moment, he couldn't think or even breathe. The cold spot jabbed harder into his neck. "In the car. Now." Thomas unfroze, jerked the door open, and got in behind the wheel. The shadow slipped behind him and into the back seat and closed the door, quickly and soundlessly. Then the cold spot was back on his neck again.
"How are you doing, Chris?"
the voice said. The words friendly, but the voice that spoke them was cold and empty.
"Who are you?"
"A friend of a friend. Somebody who asked me to stop by and say hello."
"I don't... what friend? What do you want from me?"
"Oh, I think we both know what I want,"
the voice said with reptilian amusement.
"You've been ignoring our mutual friend, and he hates to be ignored, hates it like hell."
For emphasis, the man jabbed at Thomas's neck with the gun barrel. It hurt.
"Is that how you treat a good friend? Somebody who lends you that much money from the goodness of his heart?"
Thomas now knew who had sent this man. He had known on some level since the man came at him out of the shadows, but now he was quite sure. He had half expected something like this ever since he'd borrowed the money. It had been a truly stupid move, one of the few really dumb things he'd ever done. But he'd needed the money.